Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ari Shapiro, filling in for Ken Rudin.
Welcome, Ari, and pleasure to have you with us this week. Ari, of course, was in New Hampshire on Monday night for the first New Hampshire debate between the Republican candidates for 2012 nomination and really the fullest field we've seen thus far among these candidates.
Yep, seven of them up on stage, many of them for the first time, even though there was an earlier debate in South Carolina. Many of them were not there. And what we saw was really not so much them going after each other as them going after President Obama.
A pretty understandable thing to do at this stage of the campaign. After all, we're not right up to the voting yet, and they still need to identify themselves and introduce themselves, in some cases, to the American public. They don't want to come across as being bad Republicans. They don't want to seem to be violating Ronald Reagan's 11th Commandment and all that sort of thing, at least not right away, because they first want to establish themselves in terms of their bona fides with the Republican conservative base.
And yet, what's a little odd is that just the day before the debate, former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty was on Fox News Sunday attacking Mitt Romney, the, at least for the moment, frontrunner, calling Mitt Romney's Massachusetts health care plan and President Obama's national health care plan Obamacare. Mm-hmm. And yet, during the debate, when John King, the moderator, pushed and pushed and pushed, Pawlenty only very begrudgingly trotted out the phrase Obamacare, and even then only to explain why it wasn't as harsh as everybody took it to be.
If it was Obamacare on Fox News Sunday, why is it not Obamacare standing here with the governor right there?
President Obama is the person who I quoted in saying he looked to Massachusetts for designing his program. He's the one who said it's a blueprint in that he merged the two programs. And so using the term Obamacare was a reflection of the president's comments.
He was really backing off of the attack. He looked rather remarkably chagrined even to be reminded that he had said this. And for a moment you thought to yourself, where are we in this process? Is he auditioning to be the man's running mate?
The vice president.
Yeah, almost thought that he was. It was also had a kind of a schoolyard face down kind of aspect to it. And Tim Pawlenty was clearly the one backing down. That has not helped his campaign. Obviously, his handlers and all the people talking for his campaign have called it a mistake. They've said, look, that didn't look good. We understand it didn't look good. It did not play well. And the other thing is that it seemed to a lot of us as though Obamacare was a perfect way of expressing exactly what Mitt Romney's biggest vulnerability on the issues may well be, the similarity between his health care plan in Massachusetts and the one that was passed by the Democratic Congress and President Obama.
Right. And if Mitt Romney has an advantage anywhere, it's in New Hampshire, where conservatives tend to be more fiscal than social conservative, where he is right in their backyard as former governor of Massachusetts. Tim Pawlenty has been spending lots and lots of time in New Hampshire, and yet people there still don't know him. He has very little name recognition there.
He has not caught fire, and it's assumed that he is going to put his early emphasis on Iowa, which is right across the state line from his home state, and makes a perfect sense, and also because it's probably just a better place for him to try to ambush Romney. Romney has not done well in Iowa. He's de-emphasizing it again this time. He's not even going to go to the straw poll in August in Ames, which is the first test, really, of the candidate's organizational strength. It's a bit of a bogus event, of course, and you have to buy a ticket to get in, and it isn't really a poll, but it is a test of organizational strength and has been taken as such in past years, and people who do well there don't necessarily win the Iowa caucuses, but they get some momentum that could be meaningful, and Tim Pawlenty's got another Minnesotan he has to contest Iowa with.
Michelle Bachmann, and her advantage in Iowa is that a huge proportion of Iowa Republican voters consider themselves evangelical Christians, and Bachmann succeeded in defining herself more broadly than the evangelical social conservative that she had portrayed herself as for the last several years. During the debate in New Hampshire, she defined herself more broadly. But the fact is, Iowa caucus goers are really going to like the religious fervor that Michelle Bachmann brings to the race, the kind of Tea Party credentials as the woman who founded the House Tea Party Caucus. If Michelle Bachmann has a leg up anywhere, it's in Iowa.
Yes, and she reminded, of course, the viewers on Monday night that that was one of her accomplishments in the House, was founding that caucus. You know, this is the Mike Huckabee crowd from 2008. They liked Mike Huckabee. He came from back in the pack as a former Baptist minister and appealed to this group of voters, galvanized this group of voters, and won the Iowa caucuses. If you want to go back a little further, way back to 1988, Bob Dole won the Iowa caucuses, but Pat Robertson, the televangelist from Virginia, who had no ties to Iowa that anyone knew about before this and was, you know, not really seen as being a terribly serious candidate for the nomination, finished second behind Bob Dole and ahead of George H.W. Bush, the eventual nominee. So this is a state where the turn out on Monday night to these long, drawn-out caucuses that go on well into the evening. It's not exactly like going to church, but it's the kind of thing that if you get organized by your church to go participate in, you might very well show up and actually take part. And the, you know, more casual political person who would show up for a vote on a Tuesday might not be that kind of motivated.
You know who I really thought was hurt by the Monday night debate? It was somebody who was not even on the stage, Sarah Palin. The fact is, Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann are often conflated as the same type, these very charismatic, very conservative women who can sort of stir up the Tea Party base. Well, the critique of Sarah Palin is that she just doesn't have the broad experience in foreign affairs, in legislating. She left her term as Alaska governor early. Bachmann presented herself as somebody who is in the House Intelligence Committee, who has substantive concerns about the approach to Libya. She presented herself as a woman of substance on Monday night. And if this is a Bachmann versus Palin matchup, I think Bachmann really took the lead over Palin.
There is, of course, a lurking kind of sexism about a lot of this discussion, because there's this assumption that if there's a woman in the race, that a second woman joining the race is somehow contesting that one lane and no other. That's not necessarily the case in this field. I think it's possible that Bachmann and Palin could appeal strongly enough in this field, which is not the world's strongest field. Mitt Romney is the front runner, no question. He's out in front in all the polls. He's raising the money. He has the kind of hierarchical position in the party that would seem to give him the nomination. But he's not a juggernaut, and he's really vulnerable on some of these issues. Global warming is another one, the Afghan war. There are things where he is not necessarily in the wheelhouse of the average primary voter, maybe not in South Carolina, maybe not in some of these other states. So you can get this guy if you've got the right candidates, and it's possible that two of the people who could contest for that vote would both be women. The problem is, as you say, Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann are very much focused on similar voters. And when Michelle Bachmann started to emerge, she reminded a lot of people of Sarah Palin and seemed to be almost a stalking horse for her campaign. That kind of thinking is gone.
So I think the question for Mitt Romney is, has the Republican Party morphed from sort of the, if you'll pardon the stereotype, aristocratic country club conservative to the Tea Party populist conservative? Mitt Romney is much closer to the former. The Michelle Bachmann, Sarah Palin type is much closer to the latter.
That's right. And I think to some degree, this is the function of the early voting events. Iowa, New Hampshire, Florida, and Nevada all give a role to the kind of Republican that you're talking about, as opposed to the 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago cliche notion of who a Republican had to be. So the Tea Party is really going to assert itself, I think, throughout this process. We're going to see it in the debates and the reactions to the debates, the straw poll in Iowa. I think we're going to see a very strong Tea Party influence in those early voting states. And that's going to have a lot to do with whether or not Mitt Romney can nail this one down. And by the way, he's got to contend with another candidate who's joining the field next week, who is also a Mormon candidate and has a lot of his own moderate credentials with that part of the party, and is going to try a little bit of his honor on from that direction.
Former Utah Governor John Huntsman, who was also President Obama's ambassador to China, which could be a liability to him in the Republican primary.
That's an odd thing, that somebody's last office, the main reason most Americans have heard of him, is actually a gift from the man he wants to run against.
You know, it's a far cry from 2000, when President Bush said, "I'm a uniter, not a divider." Today, Republicans, it seems to me, are looking for a divider, somebody to make a clean, strong break from President Obama. And that means John Huntsman is going to have to prove to the Republican primary voters that he is not in debt to the current president.
Another potential candidate whose name has been mentioned a lot of late would certainly not be confused with any debt to Barack Obama, and that's Rick Perry, the governor of Texas.
Right.
Man's been governor of Texas since George W. Bush left back in late 2000. Longest-serving governor in that state's history, and, well, he may remind some people of George W. Bush in some ways, but he does represent what is the second largest state in the country, and he does represent both fiscal and social conservatism, and he would add yet another flavor to the mix.
And so he's been playing the will he or won't he run game, but one sign that looks good for Perry is that a lot of Newt Gingrich's staffers who left the Gingrich campaign are big Perry supporters and heading over to Texas.
That's right. When we last left the podcast, we still had Newt Gingrich in the game. And, of course, that is still technically true. But based on the departure of 16 members of his senior staff, including all of his top people in his national campaign, in his Iowa campaign, in his New Hampshire campaign, his South Carolina campaign, decamped en masse. And he says he's going to carry on with a different kind of campaign based on new technology. And judging by the performance that he gave in New Hampshire, that's going to be awfully tough uphill work.
Well, Ron, you will no doubt be eager to learn that according to the Newt Gingrich campaign surrogate who I spoke to in the spin room after the debate, the campaign is in the perfect place. They are exactly where they want to be and could not be stronger. So while this was all playing out in New Hampshire, President Obama left the continental United States.
Well, he was fulfilling a pledge. He went to Puerto Rico, and while a couple of other presidents have done a sort of drive-by in Puerto Rico over the last 50 years, this is the first official visit since 1961 and JFK. Now, Obama was there as a candidate and said if he won, he'd come back, so he fulfilled that pledge. But, you know, the message that he was sending by being there was probably being sent over the heads of the people in the audience in Puerto
Rico.
Back
to the Puerto Ricans in the U.S. And let me just say as a side note, Ron, I appreciate your sending me to the sunny, cool climes of New Hampshire rather than the hot, humid, sticky Puerto Rico, which is just so unpleasant this time of
June.
Year.
It is June. We might be able to reverse that in the wintertime. It was a pretty good event that he had there in Puerto Rico, but it was really kind of a one-day distraction because there are so many major headaches for the administration, for the White House back here in town.
Right. He came back to a fight with Congress over Libya.
You know, it has been surprising, I think, to some of us who, after 8 years of the Bush administration, which was such a strong national security administration, such a strong aggressive military posture administration, to suddenly hear the Republicans being quite so concerned about the exercise of powers of a military nature and an aggressive foreign policy by the White House, when that was not their concern for the previous 8 years.
What's so funny to me is that this fight over Libya is all about executive authority, which was the single focus of the Bush administration for 8 years. President Obama has played it down a lot, but this argument about whether he needs permission under the War Powers Act from Congress to continue the activity in Libya is all an argument over executive authority, not all that different from the ones that the Bush administration had over torture, over domestic spying, over everything related to the war on terror that was so controversial.
So it's ironic, to put it mildly, that we suddenly have a Democratic administration doing many of the same sort of high-handed things. I mean, their excuse for being in Libya and not ever asking Congress for any kind of permission of any sort, really, I mean, and the consultation was pretty underwhelming. They suddenly say, well, you know, it doesn't really fall into the War Powers Act because while there are a lot of bombs falling and a lot of artillery fire, a lot of guns going off and people dying, it ain't a war. Well,
it's
not from our standpoint.
It's what they call a kinetic military action, or as I like to refer to it, cardio.
Yeah.
On alternate days I lift weights, and on the other days I do kinetic military action.
And their legal point of view is, it may be a war for the Libyans, it may be a war for NATO, which is taking part in, on the side of the rebels, but it's not a war for us because we don't have any troops there. We don't have any actual personnel there. And to whatever degree there may be exceptions to that, and I think most of us assume there are CIA personnel and who knows who else operating in the country, we don't have any troops there. We're not actually flying the planes and the missions, and we're not actually doing the things that people would consider war making.
But the fact is, 50 years ago, war meant something very specific. And today, war can mean a whole range of things that may or may not include troops on the ground. Look at the number of unmanned Predator drone strikes that the U.S. has staged. These strikes actually have a real impact on the ground. They end lives. They kill people. And yet, under the Obama administration's definition, it's not an act of war because there aren't troops on the ground. It's a gray area that extends really all over the world right now.
So we're waiting to see just how far Congress wants to push this confrontation. You have, on the one hand, a group of Democrats, particularly in the House, perhaps led by Dennis Kucinich, although I wouldn't limit it only to his coterie, who say, look, this is just the same thing we had with Bush, as you were suggesting. We shouldn't cut any kind of slack to a Democratic president to deal in this high-handed way with Congress and foreign policy any more than we would for a Republican. You have that group of Democrats. It's not a majority, but it's a strong group. And then over on the Republican side, you have a lot of ambivalence because you have people who believe in a strong executive and did support the Bush-Cheney doctrines of those 8 years, but who feel very uneasy about supporting the same thing when it's done by a Democratic president or at least by Barack Obama, with whom they don't feel comfortable.
And, of course, the Obama White House's greatest wish is that Gaddafi leaves and this all becomes moot.
That's right. The administration would like nothing better than to see Gaddafi essentially do what Anthony Weiner finally did, and that is have an announcement that you're resigning and get off the stage.
You don't mean tweet inappropriate photos of Muammar Gaddafi.
For all we know, Muammar's been doing that for decades, and he just hasn't been caught. He's been doing it under a nom de plume.
So Congressman Weiner finally took the hint, finally stepped down.
The hint. Wow.
The hint.
I think we could call it a capital H hint. Every Democratic politician north of city councilman has called on him to resign because he had become such an embarrassment, not only for the House of Representatives Democrats or for the House or for New York City, but really for the whole professional class of politicians.
For social media.
Yeah,
for
also an embarrassment to social media. Consider how far that would necessitate your going. Well, so much has been said about the whole Anthony Weiner thing. I guess my question at this point is, does it end a scandal when the principal figure actually resigns, or does the scandal kind of linger? Does it remain as a bruise on the party, on the institution?
I have an easy answer to that question for you. Poll 100 Americans and ask them to name three of the dozen people who have had sex scandals in the last 5 years. And in the moment, we all knew about Elliot Spitzer and the prostitutes. We all knew about
Christopher Lee. Arnold Schwarzenegger.
And yet, are people
David
on the street
Mitter.
Aware of how many Republicans, how many Democrats, how many governors, members of the House and Senate were caught in sex scandals? It holds people's attention while it's happening, but then it's on to the next scandal and nobody remembers the last one.
Mark Sanford.
Going to the Appalachian Trail.
I've forgotten it.
And Ron, in this part of the podcast, we have to speak in hushed voices because this weekend, President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner will be playing a round of golf.
That's right. The president now is reaching into his golf bag, and I believe he's going to select a 9-iron for this particularly tricky shot out of the rough.
And resist the urge to smack House Speaker Boehner upside the head with that club.
You know, it's been observed that John Boehner is a chain smoker and may be tempted to smoke out here on the course. Barack Obama, as we know, has recently kicked, or says he's kicked, the habit of smoking, which can be a hard thing to do when you are with a chain smoker.
Inhaling secondhand smoke. I imagine President Obama standing next to the House Speaker, inhaling deep lungfuls of that secondhand smoke coming out of the Speaker's cigarette.
There could be a danger here, though, Ari, because you know the foursome is being filled out by the Ohio Governor John Kasich, a rather loquacious fellow in his years here in Congress, and also by Vice President Joe Biden,
who makes Kasich look like a blushing wallflower.
That is correct, and so I am wondering if it's going to be safe to light up any cigarette in an environment where all the oxygen has been taken up by those two individuals.
Let alone the hair product that could catch on fire.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ari Shapiro.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.